Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Welcome to the live version of Flight Safety Detectives. I'm Todd Curtis. I'm here with Greg Fife and John Golia. And we're going to cover a couple of topics today. Roughly 15 hours ago, there was a fatal accident involving an Air Canada aircraft at LaGuardia. And I think our viewer, Fatmans28, said it best. We need some details from the OG Go team. That would be you, Greg, and you, John. So, as you were, let's talk about what happened at LaGuardia last night, which was Sunday night around 11:30 p.m. local time in New York.
Yeah, Todd, you know, it's always good to be with you guys. Unfortunately, we're doing this live show on the heels of an accident that took place at 11:45 at night. It was an Air Canada CRJ-900, which is the largest version of the CRJs. There were over 70 people, including crew, on the aircraft. And on touchdown, they started the landing roll just fine. But unfortunately, they collided with a fire truck that was cleared to cross runway 4 at LaGuardia. And everyone who is familiar with LaGuardia knows that the airport is very confined. You have intersecting runways that are perpendicular. So, of course, they were using runway 4, apparently, for the landings, and the perpendicular runway for takeoff. Now, the fire truck was sitting at taxiway Delta, which is almost halfway down that runway, and they were waiting to cross because they were responding to an emergency call by a United Airlines aircraft that had rejected a takeoff. And so the system, the air traffic controller provided a clearance for the fire truck to cross. Unfortunately, the runway was occupied by the Air Canada airplane. John?
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know you were done.
I'm done.
Well, this is a very frustrating accident from my point of view because it has too many identical pieces to the Washington, D.C. crash. And it's just another example of the FAA not learning from their mistakes. You know, and I was pretty angry with the FAA a little while ago because leaving one person in the tower working two positions in an airport like LaGuardia, and even though they might have thought it was a slow night, all it took was one rejected takeoff that changes the whole night activity. So you got an airplane that rejected a takeoff. It's on the end of the runway to the left of the airplane it was landing, and you bring an emergency equipment out there from the right-hand side of the airport where it all lives. So trying to get all the equipment out there to the top left of this diagram here, it's a challenge. You're crossing a couple of different runways, and it's a busy time. There's a lot of airplanes still moving, and this one poor guy in there made a mistake, and I hope they get him some help. But the frustration I feel is not only that he made a mistake, but because they left him alone in the tower, he had to keep working after a major emotional event like that. He had to keep directing aircraft for about an hour, which is absolutely nuts. You know, and it's crossed my mind a few times since this accident happened. We keep claiming shortage of air traffic control, shortage of air traffic control personnel. Well, damn it, Reagan brought in the military. Why don't we bring the military in to fill the manpower shortage until they get their act together and hire some more controllers?
Yeah. And
there's relief available. They just don't take advantage of it.
Well, you know, and they're depending on, I think, the upgrades, the money that they're throwing at the air traffic control system, but that does not fulfill the pipeline of the humans that it takes to control these aircraft. And like you said, John, when you have a controller who's working both ground and local, you know, it is a choreographed dance. But now you really have to start to explore all the human factors elements. Yeah, this could be a shortage issue. It could also be a reduction in staffing, because at night, typically when the arrival rates go down, so do the staffing levels. So that'll be an interesting question. And like you said, it does mirror some of the same issues that were brought up in the midair over Washington a year and a half ago. But it also has overtones of a number of events. I investigated a Republic Airways DC-9 that struck a snowplow on the runway during a snowstorm. The airplane was cleared to land. The snowplow hadn't cleared the runway. The air traffic controller couldn't see the snowplow. It was depending on position reports, and then unfortunately the DC-9 on rollout struck the snowplow. And then when we were talking off air, again, it's all about communication. We had a U.S. Air 737 land on a metro liner at Los Angeles International Airport. And again, the controller put the aircraft in position on the runway, but then forgot about that aircraft. And the question will be here, given that this controller was working multiple positions, was talking on another, talking to another aircraft, and then, of course, talking to the crew of the fire truck, is there a distraction issue? Is there a complacency issue? Is there, you know, some element of loss of situational awareness where the controller forgot that he had cleared that aircraft to land on the runway? And even if the aircraft was on the runway, did he lose sight of it, because they're supposed to have visual observation of the traffic on the occupied runway?
We have a couple of questions from the audience. One of them from Helen Scottish Lama. The aircraft has clearance before the fire truck, then the fire truck was later given clearance. The mistake was realized, but it was too late. Is this a proper synopsis of what you think went on?
John, go ahead.
That encapsulates it based on what the information has been given out so far. But when the air traffic controller repeatedly said stop, stop, stop to the fire truck, did he hear it? Was it stepped on by another transmission? So that's one of the first questions that needs to be asked and answered, is did that communication from the controller, when he realized his mistake, did it reach the fire truck? Did it reach those guys? And did they have time to react, is the second part of that question.
So, and another question from the audience
Hang in there 1 second, Todd. There's another aspect to that, John. Again, now you have the controller telling the crew of the fire truck, stop, stop, stop. Well, if they're in the middle of the runway, was that the right command? Rather than get off the runway, get off the runway, get off the runway. You know, we've seen this. We saw it at JFK, where we had a Delta Airlines and an American Airlines airplane, where the American 777 crossed over the runway while there was a departing 737. And you had two different controllers, two different frequencies, telling the crews to do the same thing, and that is stop, stop, stop. Well, that 777 was right in the middle of the runway. So was that the right command? So I think phraseology will be one of the issues that needs to be discussed with regard to the commands that were given. And yes, it may have been too late or one or both of the vehicle and the aircraft to take any kind of evasive action. But that has to be looked at. The words that are used, the terminology, and then the positioning of those aircraft, of those two objects when the command was given.
And the timing.
We have two questions from Billaronic 311. The first one was, am I correct that the controller was working both arrivals and ground? And the second question, shouldn't the controller at the same time have told the CRJ to go around?
I think the CIJ was committed. It was too low. He may have actually been on the ground when the commands came. So we have to look at that, the timing of all of that. The NTSB will bring that right down to a nanosecond if they have to, where the airplane was when the commands came to make any changes.
The other thing, Greg,
you know, did you hear, did he say to fire truck when he said stop, stop, stop?
He said he told truck one to stop, yes. And so the other thing is that with the cockpit voice recorder, it will be interesting to really understand what did the two pilots see during the course of the approach, if the airplane was in fact on the ground when the command was given, because there may not, they were already in the deceleration phase of the touchdown, so they were committed to stay on the ground. They would not have had enough airspeed / energy to get the airplane airborne again. That's why the timeline is going to be very critical, and really understand from the CVR conversation what in fact the crew did see. Did they see the flashing lights on that fire truck? Did they see the fire truck on the runway? So there's a lot of visual cues that the board's going to have to try and ferret out as well.
And we have a question right now from Jason Luke Solo, 7718, it's clear to me that there wasn't just a single controller in the cab. There was someone else talking to planes on the ground frequency, including the United flight that had rejected, I'm assuming it means had rejected a takeoff.
You know, a lot of these airports, and we've seen that before, especially at Newark and Kennedy, where you have split controllers. One controller is handling the departures on that perpendicular runway. Another controller is handling the arrivals, like in this case on runway 4. They aren't on the same frequency. So again, that's the kind of the same thing that was happening in Washington with the midair, because they were communicating on a separate frequency to the helicopters versus the fixed wing. And so while the outbound was heard, the inbounds may not have been heard. The other thing was there any communication from the controller to the fire truck that would have been heard by the Air Canada crew to give them situational awareness that, hey, that fire truck is crossing runway 4 and that's the runway we're landing on?
So one other piece is on that ATC tape that's been broadcast, there, when he says he makes a mistake, he's being responded by somebody, but that person apparently was not in the tower cab. That was what we think was Frontier.
Because the controller had been talking to a Frontier airplane just prior to the collision, telling him hold their position at that time. So it may have been that Frontier crew. It may have even been the airplane that they asked to abort the takeoff and gave them a heading and an altitude to fly.
And Billaronic 311 has another question from his view of what another channel, VASF Aviation, had shown. It looks as though the CRJ had not crossed the runway 4 threshold when the command was given. Was that the case from what you've seen?
From the early indication, again, you know, you got to be careful with ADS-B data coming from a variety of sources because they use different algorithms, which changes the position of the aircraft. The fidelity is going to come through the investigative process with the FAA giving the NTSB the best available ADS-B data. That's why it's going to be so critical to build the timeline and position the aircraft versus the vehicle. If the aircraft was still airborne, again, it was all the timing, because the controller gave the command and then there was a period of time that that transpired before the controller started telling truck one to stop, stop, stop. Well, again, that airplane isn't static. I mean, they're landing at, you know, 115, 120 knots. So they're covering a lot of ground over a short period of time.
And the voice recorder will help us immensely there, because the transmissions from the tower will be recorded on the voice recorder, and we'll be able to see if it was before landing, just before, you know, how many seconds before touchdown, or how many after touchdown before that stop was transmitted.
And some
and
of the
one of our members are, if I mean, one of our members, Karina PH Fly, seems to be agreeing with John about what John said earlier. She was saying that there's no way they could go around. The FAA had not given the ATC enough staff. I can't believe that the FAA still hasn't learned. There's a video, and there was no chance for either. Do you think that's overstating a point, or is that in line with what you're thinking here?
Well, again, it's very early. I know that, you know, we all know, based on the information that, you know, we've gotten from our sources, we have a pretty good idea. But there's always a backstory, and you have to let the investigative process play out and develop all those facts, conditions, and circumstances before you just blanketly say it was, you know, generically this or something like that. Yes, the obvious is that the controller and the communication broke down. You had on the runway. But the big question here is, how did that happen? What was the scenario, the environment? What was the working environment that allowed that to occur? Especially with all the notoriety that the midair had in Washington, and the fact that staffing is a big issue. I know that Secretary Duffy gave a press conference, you know, almost, you know, just recently. And again, what's he working off of to make the comments when the investigation is just ramping up?
I didn't get to hear his comments that he made, but I hope he didn't step into it like the previous secretary did with the value jet adventure.
But again, you know, the administration, right after the midair in Washington, they were very quick to point the finger at a lot of different entities with a lot of different responsibility. And, you know, the investigative process kind of, you know, tamped some of that down and then ramped up other aspects of it. So again, we're early into this. It's obvious that there was a lack of communication, proper communication and coordination. And the question is, how was that situation allowed to evolve?
Now, you mentioned several things about Secretary Duffy, who's a political appointee. And recently, there had been a firing of a NTSB board member, Todd Inman, for a variety of reasons that were stated. And there's some pushback from Inman saying that this was not properly done. So I'm not saying that there's going to be any political influence in this investigation, but what role do you think politics is currently playing in the NTSB that's, I wouldn't say inappropriate, but not a normal relationship that usually happens between the political leadership and the independence of the NTSB?
Well, I can tell you, when I was there, we guarded our independence very well. But the current events, Todd's not the first one. We lost a board member a year ago, maybe, fired as well. So it's changed the dynamics dramatically, because that has never happened before. And I would have fought vehemently that there was no politics in the decisions that the NTSB makes. I don't know that I can say that today, because I don't care who you are. When all of a sudden there's only five members, you get two of the five members fired, and there's some indication he was fired because he disagreed with the White House. And if that's the case, then it's clear that that's political influence.
Yeah, the board.
As Helen Scott Ashlama says, we're down to three members. There's no one in the pipeline right now to replace slot number 4 and 5. Is that correct?
No, we have four members.
Okay, not three. Okay. Sorry about that.
Yeah, and when you look at it, the board, you know, like John said, it is its independence that gives it its authority. And I remember when I was traveling down to do US Air 1016, the Secretary of Transportation wanted to fly on the G4 with the team. And I said no, because I was the investigator in charge. I said that it would have been improper for the Secretary of Transportation to be traveling with a team that is supposed to be independent. Now, we do take the FAA with us because they are an automatic party to the investigation, and we travel together. And at that time, the FAA was the one that was operating the aircraft. But there's no impropriety there, given the fact that they do have 9 areas of responsibility that they need to cover. And the NTSB is not at a loss for words when it attacks the FAA based on facts, conditions, and circumstances when they've done something wrong. But to have a high-ranking official, especially like a secretary who would be traveling with the team, that has at least a perception of impropriety.
Given the current status of the FAA and the NTSB, would that be true today? Could the investigator in charge, if he or she were on a G4 going into an accident, and the administrator said, "I'd like to fly with you," do you think they would have the, could they say no and not get fired?
I don't know in this political environment.
Yeah, I wouldn't touch that one. But I want to amend a little bit about the three board members, the question that came in. Because after Todd Inman was fired, the Senate immediately took up a person who was waiting for confirmation on the suspension of rules. They did some real fancy gyrations to bring that person's nomination forward so that they would continue to have 4 members on the board. So it was obvious that that was a rush to get that 4th member confirmed. I think it was just the very next day.
Yeah.
Now there's an international dimension to what's going on that is interesting or unusual in this case. This model of aircraft has been involved in 3 events, 2 at LaGuardia, 1 in Toronto, 2 of which resulted in the destruction of the aircraft. And is there anything that you've seen from the previous 2 investigations, a near miss at LaGuardia and, of course, the crash in Toronto, that shows there's any animosity or friction between the Transportation Safety Board of Canada and the NTSB? And could there be any...
Yeah. When you look at safety, there is no competition when it comes to safety. There may be competition, there may be political overtones and a variety of other things, but when it comes to aviation safety, even under the worst of circumstances, I've never had an issue. And I've worked the Swiss Air accident up in Halifax and a number of accidents involving either a Canadian carrier or a Canadian-made aircraft. And again, the working relationship, especially at the technician level, is very good. Everybody is out for finding, the cause, the contributing factors. Now, are there some political overtones that may filter out because of especially the environment we're working under the last few years? Possibly, but the facts speak for themselves, and the Canadians are not going to withhold information. They have a very good Transportation Safety Board up there with a number of qualified people that can provide assistance. And the manufacturers, as we've talked about on this show in prior shows, is it does not behoove anybody, whether it's the Canadian government or the manufacturer, to withhold information, because it has more of a detrimental effect if the board were to find something out that was withheld by the government or the manufacturer. So in this case, the aircraft isn't to blame. Unfortunately, the aircraft, like the folks on the aircraft, were victims. They ended up striking an object, and the airplane is only built to a certain standard, and it's not to strike objects like this and plow through like a train locomotive might.
And John, I know your time might be short with us, but I think you have some perspective on this whole issue of runway incursions, which has been a focus of the NTSB and the FAA for years. And you've both been involved in events where there was some sort of collision with an object on the ground. What could you say is the things that have been learned well and things that still need to be learned and implemented, given what happened last night?
Listen, every time you have equipment on the airport, airplanes that cross runways, the risk is elevated for a problem. That's why certain airports have much lower risk, because they have parallel runways that they can use, for example. Some of them, like LAX, have four runways, but yet we've seen they had a problem with the US Air 737 that landed on the commuter airline. So it's people, it's communications, it's conditions. There's all sorts of variables in there that make it very, very difficult to single in and focus on one primary cause. It's got to be a whole blanket approach, just like the change in air traffic control has to be all or nothing, because you just can't do it piecemeal. It's just counterproductive if you try to do it piecemeal. So you really have to come in. And we've had a number of studies about runway incursions, and I think we better refresh those up for what's happened in a recent time. Because the last study we did was several years ago, many years ago actually, and the traffic that we have today is maybe twice as much as what we had back when we did the last review. So we have a very busy system. People, you know, it's hard to comprehend that we have how many airplanes over our head right now. 6,000, 7,000 airplanes in the air, just more. In the US right now. I mean, it's just a lot of airplanes flying. And you think, oh, it's a big sky. Well, it may be a big sky, but they're all on invisible roadways in the sky, getting from point A to B, because you have to have them orderly, you have to have them in stream, essentially. It takes a lot to choreograph all that.
And with that, I would like to thank you, Greg and John, for being here today. It's very insightful things that you've given myself and to the audience. I'd like to thank all of our members and the audience who showed up today. We thank you for being here. We want you to continue to participate, like our podcast, share it with your friends. And also, if you have further questions that we couldn't get to today, by all means, email us at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. And we'd also like to thank our sponsor, Avemco. They've been a very good friend of the show for as long as we've been around. And Greg and I, in particular, have active insurance with Avemco. And if you are a listener of the show and you would like to get insurance from Avemco, mention us, and they will give you a 5% discount. And with that, Greg, I think you have a couple things to say to our advertisers.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we value on this show is the folks that support this show. It is all about safety, and that's why I have my insurance with Avemco, because they insure my airplane, as a flight instructor, and as a renter, I also get my insurance through them. One of the other things is we have PAMA, which is the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association. It's an organization that really challenges the skills of maintenance people to do it right, even when nobody's looking. And all of us preach that message, that safety message. So it's valuable insight. And in this particular accident, again, when we're dissecting things, we're not being critical. We're trying to identify those issues to make improvements to aviation and aviation safety. And while, yes, it's real obvious to, point the fingers and say, you should have done this, you should have had more people, you should have. The fact is that the system right now is slightly broken. Is it completely broken? No, because if it was, we'd have a lot more catastrophes than we are having right now. But we have to deal with these shortcomings. And it's important for all of us to remember that there is additional work to be done, additional information to be ferreted out before we come to, a conclusion that may be wrong. And unfortunately, this early into the investigative process, Todd, it's very easy to get things wrong, because as the facts come out, the storyline changes. You and I have both been there. We have both developed a lot of information early on. We've tried to keep it in context. Does it change? Absolutely. And I have no problem changing, or at least discussing the change. as new information comes out. And there may be even new information that comes out later today, because the NTSB is supposed to hold a briefing about what they have learned since last night on this particular event. So we may get some new information that could possibly change not all of the storyline, but part of the storyline. So it's important to keep all of this in context, because again, when we have our sponsors who promote our show, they're looking at the safety aspects for progress. And as I preach it all the time, it's about progress, not perfection. Unfortunately, perfection creates a bit of a tunnel vision, because you get so focused on trying to make one aspect perfect that you lose sight of the big picture. And that's why, as long as you have positive progress, yes, it has to be timely. Yes, it has to be effective, but it has to happen. And, you know, the question is, how did another accident like this occur where there are similar circumstances to accidents in the past? And again, it's very frustrating, and I know John is frustrated. I think we all are, and we know, we believe that there isn't politics that are influencing the decisions. But in this particular instance, you have a controller who is going to pay a very large mental price for a mistake. And it's really incumbent that, regardless of where the chips fall, that this controller is still human. John and I have been through a number of accidents together where it took a toll on some of the people involved, including a couple of feds, where they took their own life because they couldn't live with that guilt. And while these are tragic circumstances, and we've lost two pilots and injured a number of other folks involved in this event, again, we are human, we're not infallible. And unfortunately, these types of errors do happen. We know that they don't happen regularly. These are rare events, but we have to learn from them and promote the positive side. We cannot keep, you know, looking back at the negative and pointing the finger, because that apparently hasn't gotten us anywhere. We have to come up with positive solutions, and they have to be implemented now. And budget concerns and everything else, and the politics that goes with that portion of aviation safety, has to go away. It cannot continue, because we will have additional events like this if we aren't careful.
Thank you all.